From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United Nations has declared the war in Yemen as the, quote, world's worst humanitarian crisis. 4 years into a war led by Saudi Arabia, with advisory and weapons support from the US, UK, and other Western nations, the poorest Gulf Arab nation lies in ruins. Tens of millions of Yemenis, about three quarters of the population, are in need of food and/or medical aid. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has pointed out that Yemen's children are the worst victims, with, quote, nearly half of all children aged between 6 months and 5 years old chronically malnourished. The UN warning comes in the wake of a US visit by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the White House, where President Donald Trump met with him to discuss selling Saudi Arabia more weapons, even as members of the U.S. Congress have questioned our support for the Yemen war. Now a new book puts into historical context the Saudi war on Yemen, tracing back foreign interference in the small nation over several decades. Isa Bloomi is an associate professor in the Department of Asian, Middle Eastern, and Turkish Studies at Stockholm University. He's the author of Ottoman Refugees, 1878 to 1939, Foundations of Modernity, and Reinstating the Ottomans. He joins me to discuss his new book, Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. Welcome to the program, Isa.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for the opportunity, Sonali.
So you write in your book that the current war in Yemen is in part a result of the manipulation of a faith that the U.S., the KSA, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, French, Israeli, British, and Qatari intelligence agencies knew could lead to a violent disaster for Yemen. Most of us here in the United States know very little about Yemen beyond the war that began 4 years ago. How have all of these countries that I just listed, what is their interest in Yemen pre-war? What have they wanted from this small Gulf Arab nation that lies just to the south of Saudi Arabia?
To answer that question would require a book in itself, hence the book. But it's a little bit more convoluted than presented in that way, because in fact, all the members of this so-called coalition seem to have very divergent interests with Yemen, which while it's often treated as a marginal importance to the greater scheme of events in the Middle East, it is indeed the largest country, geographically speaking, second to Saudi Arabia, but in terms of the population, in terms of its potential oil, gas wealth, as well as its other natural resources that have yet to be exploited, it more or less becomes this very important potential resource for countries in the larger region that are seeing increasingly the pressures to maintain and sustain a rentier state kind of regime, as well as contribute to the global economy in ways that are serviceable to global capital. So global capital, which has long used the role of the Saudi Arabia, for instance, to fight its various conflicts or wars with, let's say, the communist regimes of in the Cold War context, to struggle against non-compliant regimes in the Middle East after the Cold War, with the examples of Iraq, Syria, and Libya most prominent. Similarly, Yemen has faced the consequence of these kinds of ambitions. Now, again, within the coalition, which extends to a number of countries in the Middle East and the larger world, there are more subtle conflicts which are not really discussed in the media. But perhaps the most evident one has materialized in the form of this struggle between Qatar and its former GCC partners. I'll be happy to elaborate on that if you wish, but let's just for the purposes of answering your first question, recognize that Yemen is a treasure trove of natural resources that have yet to be fully tapped, and that's certainly something that even a country like Saudi Arabia has been eyeing with considerable interest.
Right. And the current war, of course, is a direct response to the overthrow of both pro-Western, but more importantly, perhaps for this question, pro-Saudi government in Yemen. And so, of course, Saudi Arabia is trying to not just stave off outside influences such as Iran within Yemen, but maintain its own role there. Now, your book is primarily a history book. What role, and you alluded to this just now in your answer, what role specifically did Yemen play in the Cold War? What is the relevance of Yemen in the Cold War?
Yemen, as we know it today, was actually for most of the Cold War a divided territory. The north and northwestern part of Yemen, if you will show a map at some point during the show, people will be able to identify that area that immediately borders Saudi Arabia, the area which is today facing the brunt of the air campaign led by Saudi Arabia, and where upwards of 20 million people live currently. Was an independent, what we would call imamate, or an area that was ruled by a family and an extended kind of ruling intellectual class since the end of the Ottoman Empire in 1918. And they have long resisted the expansion of first the Saudi family as it incrementally conquered Western Arabia. What today is Mecca, Medina, we associate with Saudi Arabia, was indeed an independent polity up until the mid-1920s. And then further, as the Saudis expanded southwards, it faced direct opposition from North Yemen. In the Cold War, with Britain still maintaining its last bit of control over the affairs of some of mostly coastal South Yemen until 1967, North Yemen had been long a defiant actor in the global scene, if you will. It's largely forgotten today, but the imamate, up until 1962, when they were finally overthrown by a coup, had been on the forefront of resistance to expanding European interests. They had long supplied weapons to the resistance to South Yemen. They had were one of the first states to oppose the creation of Israel, and had often negotiated with Egypt, Syria, and Iraq, and creating a kind of pan-Arab state, what would later become recognized as the quintessential, let's say, leftist answer to American and British policies of supporting...
Right, like we've seen in so many post-colonial states, right?
That's correct. So ironically enough, a monarch, as it's used in the literature, was actually on the forefront of resisting other monarchies in the Middle East, largely because they understood on principle that the overt materialism of these emerging oil states and their close connection to global empire was a direct affront to the interests of the people of the region. And they would continue, northern Yemenis would continue to play this role, although again, in the historiography of the Middle East, it's largely been ignored now because of various associations Yemen conjures up in the literature. Nevertheless, northern Yemen has long been the kind of thorn in the side of not only Saudi Arabia, but its larger, let's say, paymasters, the global empire.
Right. So currently there's mass starvation in Yemen because of the Saudi-imposed blockade by land, air, and sea. Saudi Arabia is claiming that it's trying to prevent Iranian weapons from entering, but of course it's also preventing food and other aid from coming in. But even before the war, what were the factors that led to Yemen remaining so impoverished despite its natural resources and internal wealth?
This is, again, one of those sad consequences of this long struggle by the outside world to somehow influence the events that are taking place in this potentially very dynamic and very wealthy country, which would have, again, the largest population and pose a direct threat to the immediate allies of the empire further north, Saudi Arabia in particular. And one of the consequences of this long multi-decade campaign to subordinate Yemen has been the insertion of a political class. Often we associate that with the personality around Ali Abdullah Saleh, who ruled Yemen for over 30 years up until 2011 and remained an important player until his ultimate death earlier this year, and the political class that he represented, who were able to becoming incredibly wealthy from pillaging the resources of Yemen, and which were modestly, at best, exploited, if you will, in the first place. So Yemen basically suffered the consequences of in a very dynamic, very entrepreneurial, in some ways innovative society, who often provided the labor force for the Middle East, the oil countries. They had long served in the military and served in the service industries of the Gulf. Many hundreds of thousands, if not indeed millions over the decades have moved elsewhere in the world. You'll find many Yemenis in California, in the Central Valley. You'll find many Yemenis making up the political ruling elites of Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, throughout East Africa. So Yemen is not poor in human capital nor in actual natural resources. And yet it remains a country heavily impoverished by these mechanisms that had been incrementally imposed on this country and by a political elite.
Can you specify also the ways in which the sort of structural adjustment policies of major international institutions like the World Bank and the IMF have also historically played a role in keeping Yemen underdeveloped?
It's, again, a very complicated, deep history of international organizations influence peddling in Yemen. And it reflects what happened in Yemen. It very much reflects what happened in post-colonial Africa in particular. I think there are very interesting comparisons. But some of the demands that were being put on Yemen to become integrated into a global regime, I call it, or global network of whether it be in finance or whether it be in trade mechanisms or regulating trade mechanisms, was largely based on the fact that Yemenis had considerable, again, as I said, human resources. Large numbers of men, able-bodied men, were able to travel at moment's call and service the labor needs of the immediate neighboring countries or the larger world. That was the first kind of access point, if you will, of the major international organizations. Now, with the Cold War, especially with the invasion of North Yemen by Egyptian forces and then an extended war between Egyptian forces and Saudi Arabia throughout the 1960s, that it initiated heavy investment from the international community, especially the UN, in building capacity and basically providing certain kinds of services that were not possible during conditions of war. And that was the entry point, if you will, kind of a Naomi Klein kind of opportunistic moment to exploit devastation and war and disaster to intervene in the domestic affairs of a country that had long resisted this kinds of pressures from the outside world. So subsequent decades were new conflicts and periodic famines that or threats of famine due to drought that periodically visited Yemen allowed for new waves of intervention by international organizations and even especially the USAID, which became heavily invested in influencing.
Right. Let's talk developed. About that. The U.S. Mm-hmm. Agency for International Development. What role is U.S. and USAID has been notorious for many years for fomenting all sorts of chaos within countries in the guise of democratic development. What role has USAID historically played in Yemen?
What I discovered, I've always suspected that the USAID had, of course, ulterior motives. In the larger world, I've known that for as you mentioned yourself, they've become notorious. But it was specific to Yemen, it became clear to me that there was an incremental approach by the U.S. Embassy, which had limited influence over the domestic affairs of Yemen well into the 1980s, in fact. What starts the direct intervention into the domestic affairs of Yemenis was through the USAID. its precursor agencies were basically competing with Soviet and Maoist Chinese aid agencies, and they fared very poorly. They actually performed very poorly. Yemenis had always suspected that Americans were up to no good with their aid packages, which often demanded the contracts be signed with American construction companies. And the USAID somewhat retracted this kind of overt approach and tried to implement certain kinds of structural reforms that made Yemen increasingly dependent on international financing, independent on European and American donations, especially food donations. So although the country in North Yemen is very rich in agricultural traditions, have long used water in very efficient and effective ways, increasingly, certain interested parties were given the opportunity to invest in new kinds of agricultural development and emphasized export. So you have this now, much like we would find in the rest of the third world over the 1980s, this kind of reversion from being self-sufficient in food production to using agricultural lands for export purposes. And it's around the same time that Yemen starts to borrow effectively through IMF mechanisms and becomes increasingly indebted. Mm-hmm. And it's the USAID advisors who are the first ones to really promote this kind of approach. And so what happens as Yemen becomes increasingly no longer self-sufficient in food production and starts to import large amounts, U.S. wheat in particular, it changes dramatically how Yemenis eat. It changes dramatically how Yemenis allocate refunds and resources to
Yemen was importing U.S. wheat
as aid. It became, this is a kind of classic tactic of the Americans. They did the same thing with Egypt in the 1950s already. But Yemen became a net importer of food around the mid-1970s, and increasingly so, with coffee being in a point of emphasis where you could use your land, your arable land, to produce coffee. Now, it became increasingly important to produce, U.S. dollars through export, because Yemen became increasingly indebted to this international regime of finance through the IMF. So there was increasing pressure to actually produce goods and produce products that could actually be sold for currency as opposed to being consumed locally. Mm. And this became exaggerated in the 1980s when, ironically enough, George Bush Sr., the first Bush who became president while he was vice president, visits North Yemen and establishes what becomes the permanent relationship between Ali Abdullah Saleh, U.S.-American Empire, and Big Oil.
George H.W. Bush. So as vice president, you write in your book, and of course, he was the former head of the CIA, visited North Yemen in 1986 on official business. And that official business was inaugurating an Oklahoma-based oil company called Hunt Oil, their oil field. So this is also an interesting part of the U.S. Role in Yemen historically that we don't know much about. Are there still those interests in Yemen remaining today from the U.S.?
Absolutely. We should step back to the 1980s again. Mm-hmm. This is at a time when oil was around $10 to $11. There was actually no reason for investment in new oil fields.
This is a barrel, per barrel. So that's very cheap.
Per barrel, that's correct. It's very cheap. There was a collapse in oil prices at this period. And again, there was no logical reason why Hunt Oil and their main point man, the Vice President George H.W. Bush, would actually go to North Yemen and negotiate with Ali Abdullah Saleh the expanding of oil production operations in North Yemen. It was very costly, it was politically very precarious, and indeed there was more than enough oil in the rest of the world. So why were they doing this at this point in time? And what ultimately happened is that they were able to actually initiate the unification process that brought South Yemen, which had long been a very important actor in the Cold War. It was a strident Marxist, very efficient Marxist state. But it was also where you would find where Americans knew were huge supplies of potentially exploitable oil and gas. And so this was the window of opportunity where both countries were desperate for outside investment. Much of the money to develop the Hunt fields actually came from Iraq. Now, this is the old George H.W. Bush connection with Saddam Hussein that people have forgotten about. It's something that could be elaborated upon later. But the Americans became heavily invested in Yemeni oil and were the ones to actually open up Yemeni oil for global consumption. Subsequently, there have been many companies that have put the money into building infrastructure, building capacity. And even we have just last week an Austrian company restarting their export of Yemeni natural gas from its fields in central Yemen, despite the fact there's a war going on, despite the fact there are people starving to death. Tells you that oil and gas is a very important factor in this, which is never being discussed in the literature nor in media coverage today.
So fast forward to today, where you have this absolutely brutal war that I mentioned. The United Nations has now declared Yemen the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. How have both U.S. and Saudi goals or interests in Yemen either changed or stayed the same? How do we, in a contemporary sense, understand why Saudi Arabia is carrying out this war with U.S. help? I mean, it's obvious that Donald Trump doesn't understand probably the reasons why the U.S. remains there. He doesn't understand much of anything, but presumably the broader forces of the U.S. government do understand it and are invested in and some are determined to support Saudi Arabia in this very brutal war.
Again, it's a much older story, a deeper story, but let's just start from 2014, 2015, where a proxy regime that had reversed the consequences of the Arab Spring as it plays out in Yemen by 2012 had initiated a very rapid reintegration of Yemen and all its natural resources into the global economy, servicing American corporate interests, servicing Saudi strategic interests, and more importantly, pushing aside certain players who had gained a foothold in Yemen at the expense of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who are actually allies in that point of time. Now, Saudi Arabia is has huge fiscal budgetary issues. It's hemorrhaging money left and right. It's a country that cannot be sustained by its oil revenues that is increasingly threatened by oil prices falling.
And this is something that people here in the U.S. haven't really grasped, I think.
This Mohammed bin Salman tour is really a money-raising tour. It's an attempt to bring investors' money into Saudi Arabia, which otherwise is bankrupt, more or less. And it was bankrupt in March 2015. And when the pliable regime that they had helped install in Sana'a was overthrown because of the corruption, because of the injustices, and because of hunger, and ultimately a very much more popular kind of solution was put in place, which immediately said we will no longer comply with this Saudi-imposed integration of Yemen into the global economy through Saudi influence. The result was we have no choice but to intervene and try to correct the events that led to the overthrow of this, again, puppet regime under the name of a man named Hadi. And Saudi Arabia and its Obama administration allies, we must forget, this is an Obama administration-led campaign.
Right, it started under Obama, yeah.
The assumption was that this would be a quick victory, and they did not expect and anticipate a war that would last now in its fourth year. Saudi Arabia is hemorrhaging money and resources, upwards of $200 million a day. They're borrowing money from international markets, bond markets. I just saw a report, $31 billion they've borrowed internationally to help cover a $52 billion budget deficit. So bin Salman is traveling the United States and the UK to try to basically market the future potential of Saudi Arabia. But it was a lot, even in 2015, the potential of Aramco and the potential for Saudi Arabia by 2030 was if they were able to secure Yemen's resources. And Yemenis have resisted that. Now the things have gotten out of hand. It's one of its partners, the UAE, has very different ideas and a different agenda with Yemen than Saudi Arabia. And we're basically seeing fragmentation of the GCC. The first evidence of that is how Qatar has been marginalized. But now you will see increasingly the underlying pressures between UAE and Saudi Arabia also manifest. As this war continues to drag on, more and more hundreds of thousands of people are directly affected by it. It was a brutal war from the beginning. It was in many ways directed by hired guns, if you will. There are certainly mercenaries left and right on the ground. It's mostly Sudanese soldiers who are dying on behalf of Saudi Arabia on the ground.
Really?
It's Saudi air. Yes. Yeah, it's mostly hired guns. Saudis would never arm their own citizens. Most of its military and security apparatus in Saudi Arabia are controlled by outsiders. And in the war itself, it's Saudi Air Force with logistical support from the Americans and the British. Obviously, Saudi weapons are all provided by what companies that are constantly applauding this continued use of their very expensive weapons on a defenseless people who have no means to defend themselves from air attacks. The cynical use of these same kinds of cluster bombs that have been banned for a long, long time now on farms, on farmland. The destruction from the first 2 or 3 weeks of the air campaign in 2015 of factories that produced food, the destruction of water wells, the destruction of storehouses, of infrastructure that would help bring humanitarian aid if humanitarian aid was ever allowed in. These were all kind of a concerted effort to starve into submission a population who's remained defiant until today. And this is the another element of the story that's never discussed. I have to add a little commentary here. Shame on the UN, because on one hand, one side of its mouth, it's saying it's a humanitarian crisis. On the other side of its mouth, it's thanking Saudi Arabia for writing a check, which it will never pay.
Right, Saudi Arabia assistance. Has ironically pledged 930 something million or billion dollars in aid for the country it's busy bombing and blockading.
Yeah, and they just 2 days ago they just bombed a storehouse in Hodeidah, the main port entry port for North Yemen, and destroyed all the recently delivered medicines and food. So they know exactly what they're doing. They're trying to pressure North Yemen into a catastrophe and basically force these people out of hunger to submit. And that's a war crime. These are crimes that are committed by Saudi in the name of Saudi Arabia, but with the absolute necessary assistance from the Americans, the British, and others.
Well, Issa, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, helping us understand in much broader context and detail what's happening in Yemen. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you for your time.
My guest is Issa Bloomi, Associate Professor in the Department of Asian, Middle Eastern and Turkish Studies at Stockholm University. We've been discussing his book, Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find out more about us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.